So good evening. Welcome to the third part of this wonderful lecture series. I'm Rabbi Mark Sammoth. I need to introduce myself, but I don't need to introduce Dr. Tauber. Isn't that interesting? We're looking over these months at how certain sects arise, cults you can call them. How does somebody attain a following? Well, I think you're watching it. In situ. Here it is, okay? We're experiencing it. It is an absolute delight. I do not need to introduce her to you, to most of you. But if you're here for the first time, you're in for a treat. And if you're here for a second or third time, you know what a wonderful evening is in store. It's an honor, it's a pleasure to introduce Dr. Sarah Tauber.
Well, thank you everybody for coming out on May Day. How come you aren't at your polls? I say that half in jest because tonight's presentation will address the popularity of Jewish socialism and the Jews' attraction to socialism in the modern era. So I think it's appropriate that we're holding this on May 1st. I also appreciate you coming out in the middle of the week. The way this series evolved was in my discussions with Ofri Felder, who's the chair of numerous committees at the synagogue, looking at the concerns that she and I share about the potential for a real schism in Jewish life now. Are we in a schismatic era, in fact, in Jewish history, which is different than the typical two Jews, three opinions scenario, which, of course, is very much characteristic of Jewish life. But when does difference and divisiveness and argumentation tip over into real crisis? And this third talk is going to deal with Jewish politics in Poland in the interwar era. And the reason why I am addressing that topic is twofold. One, this was one of the most fractious and divisive periods in the history of the Jewish people. And secondly, we cannot really understand the politics in the Jewish world today, both in Israel and in the United States, without having a sense of its roots in interwar Poland. And in fact, this book that I'm sure many of you have already heard about that's causing a bit of a ruckus, in many ways, it doesn't deal at all with interwar Poland, except in passing, but much of what this author is addressing, really the roots of the problems are already evident in Poland between the two world wars. So I will talk for about 40 minutes or so, and then we'll take a break to schmooze a little, and then we'll come back for a Q&A and discussion, where I hope that we will connect the past with the present without too much screaming at each other. That's one of the things that I think is very important, that when we discuss these divisive issues, we are able to discuss them with a historical context and in a respectful manner, which is harder and harder, especially when it comes to politics, to have in the Jewish world. So I just will review the definition of schism that I've used in the first two sessions so that everybody remembers. The Webster Dictionary defines schism as a division, separation, discord, disharmony, or formal division or separation from a church or religious body, or a condition of disagreement in opinion, or a division of a group into two discordant groups. Now, all of these apply to the dynamics of Jewish life at one point or another, and the question is, when does this kind of division or schism become convulsive for the Jewish people, and what can we learn about it for our day? Now, there are five different ways that historians conceive of schism in Jewish history, and one of the reasons why Poland during the interwar period really is a bullseye is because all five of these indicators of schism are present in Jewish life in Poland during this time period. So there's geographic schism. And although Poland, and we'll take a look at the map in a second, Poland is one country between the two world wars, until the end of World War II, it was divided into three different empires. So in fact, when the Jews come together in Poland, they are really no longer three united Polish Jewry. They're Prussian, Austro-Hungarian, and Russian. And that's going to be a factor in the divisiveness, because over the 150 years of living under these three different empires, they developed different cultural attitudes and responses to their situation. There's then the sociological schism, which is of clashing strata within Jewish society. Here we're going to be taking a look at the influence of class. And although most Jews in Poland were either lower middle class or proletarian, but really by proletarian we mean tailors, bakers, cobblers. Very few Jews actually were working in heavy industry. So their socioeconomic profile was pretty homogeneous, although there was a bourgeoisie, but it was very small. The issue of class warfare becomes highly controversial within Jewish society, and we'll take a look at that. There's politically, you have the question of zealots and for political causes. This is absolutely evident in interwar Poland. The ideological schism, the different ways of thinking about how to be Jewish in the modern world, faith or reason, isolationist or accommodationist, nationalist or socialist, or some combination of the two, or none of the above. These become extremely divisive points of entry into the Jewish world. And then finally, spiritually, and here what we're talking about is the secularization of the Jews or an ongoing religious identity. And this becomes crucially significant as more and more Polish Jews secularize. And yet you have a very traditional way of life, and you have our Hasidim from last week, and our Misnagdim, and the battle over retaining the Jewish masses and keeping them loyal to Jewish tradition. So in every one of these, you have evidence in Poland. And finally, and a very important thing to keep in mind, is that the internal schism is often precipitated or enlarged by external factors and circumstances. And this is certainly the case in Poland in this time period, because of the way that the Polish governments and the Catholic Church behaved towards the Jews. And the Jews were really in a difficult bind during these 20 years. So I just want us to give a warning. We all know what happens to Polish Jewry. We know that 90% of them get wiped out in the Holocaust, and that's an unbelievable tragedy. I'll ask you tonight to a little bit step out of that and try not to see everything that happens through the lens of, well, they all get killed anyway, because it's very tempting to, and it's painful to realize that this vibrant culture is utterly destroyed. Now, you could say it's not utterly destroyed because it lives on in Israel. And so that's one way that we can also think of what happened. And we'll talk about that as we get to the end. But first, I want to give you a little bit of the landscape. And so we're going to do two things. And I'm going to ask you a question or two. I'd like you to first look at this map that's a front and the back. This is taken from the Encyclopedia Judaica, and I'm sorry that it looks so small. The first page has the picture of interwar Poland broken up into its various areas. You see there's Poznan, there's Pomerania in the west, there's Vilna, et cetera, in the east, and then Lublin in the center. So what I want you to be aware of in this regard is the large number where it says, for example, if you look at Lodz, where it says 31.2, that means that in the major city of Lodz, which was Lodz, 31% of the population was Jewish. If you look at the small number, the 2.2, that's the number of Jews who were in shtetls. So now I want you to put on your historian's thinking caps. What does this already tell you about the Jews in Poland in the interwar period? Just take a guess. If you look at the numbers, they are highly concentrated in urban areas. And that, go ahead.
And they were more cosmopolitan in the city. There was an intellectual ferment in the city.
Absolutely. New ideas always start in the cities. Also, the socialist movement is an urban development, especially in Poland. So this is going to attract the attention of a lot of Jews because it's in the air, as Marian said. We didn't go around getting people's names. So on the other end, we'll do that when we go to have discussion. So that's one piece that you should be aware of, the intensely urban nature of the Jewish community. Already the shtetl was on the way out. if you look population-wise, yes.
Also, the small percentage of Jews in the countryside made them more liable to violence.
The ones who were in the countryside were more susceptible, you're saying.
Yeah.
Yes, that's another interesting point. They were more vulnerable in that regard, and how would they respond to that vulnerability? Okay. Anything else? Yes.
I'm sorry if I'm jumping ahead, but we see a lot of percentages. Can you give us an idea of how many people in total lived in Poland at that time?
Yes, okay, and in fact, we're going to turn the page. You can turn to the back. But in Poland at this time, there were around 3 million Jews, and they represented 10%, approximately somewhere between 8 and 10% of the population of Poland. They were a very visible presence.
If you look at the numbers, it looks like there's more than 10%.
Looking at the cities.
You're looking at the cities. The numbers are in the big cities, right?
Only the big cities.
Right, right. So what this tells you, by the way, you should be aware, is that the Jews were highly urban, and the other populations in Poland were much less urban. In fact, the Poles and the Belarusians and the Ukrainians were much more rural. And Poland was, we'll talk about that in a minute, Poland was very backward as it comes out of World War I. It's extremely rural, a peasant society having not at all advanced industrially. Yes?
Are there any large cities that do not have a Jewish population that aren't put in?
No.
So every large city has a fairly substantial Jewish population.
Yes, it does. And that's going to be a concern for the Polish politicians, and we're going to talk about that. They see that as highly problematic. Let's turn to the back of to see the other map, and I'm sorry that they're so small. Even my eyes are being bothered by it. But this also gives you some sense of the population numbers. Okay, so now, what you have here is, you see there's a little guide on the bottom. You see it says the black square is Jews representing 200,000 to 400,000, okay, Jewish communities in 1931. The triangle is 20,000 to 100,000. The circle is 10,000 to 20,000. And the little empty square is 5,000 to 10,000. So now, just looking at this, you don't have to be a historian. What does this tell you already about the Jews in Poland? There are a lot of them. That's A. There are a lot of Jews in Poland. And that's right. They're all over the place. What is this beginning to sound like? Anti-Semites who don't want Jews there, they use this. They say there are too many of them, and they're all over the place. And we're going to discuss why that, depending on your perspective, they're right. So I want you to have that as a visual in mind. Then the next item I'd like you to turn to is the major political camps and parties. And what I'll do is, I am not going to go through in this talk, as I never do, I'm not going to go through the political platforms of all these parties. We're going to look more broadly at the thematic issues that are bringing out schism. So I hope everybody has one of these. But I do want to give you a sense of the divisiveness just by looking at the sheer numbers, and this doesn't even include all of them. These are just the major parties in interwar Poland and their ideological orientations. So obviously this is a classification system made to look neat. It was never as neat, because politics is always much messier than a piece of paper. So, but just take a look at the Jewish left. These were all founded in between 1897 to 1901, and they were founded mostly in Russia. In fact, all in Russia. And in fact, our Litvaks from last class, who were the sort of intellectual rationalists, when they defect from religious Judaism, they tend to become highly politicized. And in the context of the Russian Empire, this is the heart. The birthplace of Jewish politics is really in Vilna, in the Russian Empire, and it becomes highly socialist in orientation. So take a look. But what you also have to realize is that they're not only socialist, they're also nationalist. And so you have different versions. The Bund is Marxist, but it's nationalist, and we'll talk about what that means. And it's anti-Zionist, and it wants Yiddish. So we have differences over language. We have differences over socialism versus nationalism, or some blend of the two. And that becomes, we'll talk about that momentarily. The Jewish Center, which controlled for the first era, first decade, much of what was happening, is made up of a couple of parties who lose in power as the 20s go into the 30s. These are also founded around the turn of the century. And I just want to point out one called the Territorialist or Volkspartei, which you may have never heard of. These were what we would call diaspora nationalists. These are people who did not believe in having a homeland or in the state, in the land of Israel, but they felt that there should be some kind of national autonomy for the Jews where they were living. And we'll discuss that. They were very anti-Zionist, and they wanted Yiddish to be the language of the Jewish people, the dominant language. And we'll discuss language momentarily. Then there was the Jewish right. These parties were mutually hostile to each other. Agudas Yisrael, Hasidic, founded by the Gerer Hasidic rabbis. They were anti-Zionist, Yiddish, and they were founded in 1916. They still exist in Israel today, and we'll talk about that. And then the Revisionist Zionist, founded by Jabotinsky in the 1920s, that in today exists as the Likud party. So today, they are very friendly. Back in the day, they hated each other. We'll discuss that and why that's important. All right, for your own consideration later, there's a back page here with some general questions for you to think about in the context of how the past relates to the present, but we won't go into it right now. So I'm going to give the talk, and I'm going to give you some background information, and then I'm going to present the three themes that we're going to be looking at. That I think are crucial, and then we will take a look at why that past relates to the present. Then we will take a break, and we'll come back for discussions. But before that, I just want to start by reading to you a short excerpt from a book by the famous British author Israel Zangwill from 1907. And he wrote a short story dealing with Jewish political life in a Polish shtetl shortly before World War I. And he describes how a young man named David Ben Amram arrives in the town to organize a Jewish self-defense force as pogroms sweep the land. This is 1907. So he gets to this town hoping to drum up support. And what does he see? He had a nightmare vision of bristling sects and pullulating factions, each with its councils, federations, funds, conferences, party days, agendas, retreats, press organs, each differentiating itself with meticulous subtlety from all the other parties, each defining with casuistic minuteness its relation to every contemporary problem, each equipped with inexhaustible polyglot orators, speechifying through tumultuous nights. In such despair, unable to prevail against the political consequences, he commits suicide. So we have a description already in 1907, and it only gets more intense as time goes on and we get to Poland. So the first thing to realize is you might say, well, Jewish life in Poland was so fractious. Why didn't people just leave if they couldn't take it? Well, by this time, they couldn't leave because the doors of the country that had been accepting all those Jews, America, was now shut, especially by 1921 and then 1924 and 1927 by immigration. So any response to Jewish life had to take place pretty much in Poland, or if possible, those people who chose to go to Palestine. But Palestine was also very difficult to get to. And so people had to figure out answers where they were, even if they debated that. So that's another piece that I want you to keep in mind. Let me give you a little bit of an overview of Poland at this time period. So Poland comes out of World War I and gets its own state, but it's a state I'm going to call it by the term an ethnic nationalist state, as opposed to a civil nationalist state. What is that? An ethnic nationalist state is a state that believes that it's descent that is the most important thing in defining nationality, descent of culture, language, religion. And Poland had almost 40% of its population made up of non-Poles ethnically, namely Jews, Belarusians, Ukrainians, and small population of Germans. So it has effectively a multi-ethnic, or what they're going to call a multinational population, and it refuses to embrace the idea of a pluralistic society. It's Poland for the Poles. So this is one of the dilemmas facing the Jewish community. Now, some polls were less polling for the polls than others, but in general, the tendency, and it intensifies as the decades wear on, becomes more and more what we would today call a chauvinistic society, polling for the polls. This is going to be very important because the incubator for Zionism develops in a society that is very driven by notions of nationalism and nationhood that are determined by ethnicity. And we're going to see in the current debates that we have over what constitutes a Jewish state, those similar issues in a very eerie way are facing the state of Israel in regard to its self-definition as a nation state. I think it's best if we'll wait and just, if you have a question, write it down, because otherwise we won't get finished. So that's one thing you need to be aware of. The other thing is, this is an era in Europe of ideological extremism. You have nationalism, socialism, communism, fascism, anti-Semitism, militarism. And you really don't have much liberalism, by the way. So the Jews are swept up in all of these isms. You also have the issue of the Great Depression. And we cannot ignore the economic factors that in 1929 you have a global depression. The Jews were already economically in a fragile position. Poland was terribly backward. And the depression hit Poland very badly. And in many ways, they never got out of it, but they use the Jews as a scapegoat for trying to figure out how we're going to solve our economic problems. That's another piece that you need to be aware of. The other piece is that Jewish politics started in Russia. Russian politics were very radicalized. And the Jews bring that radicalization into the Polish political climate. You also have a very rapid secularization of the Jewish population. It's moving apace. It's still a traditional society, but for example, by the mid-1930s in Krakow, observers report that Hasidim were no longer speaking Yiddish to each other in the streets, they were speaking Polish. So Hasidim speaking Polish, does that really make sense? But that, because of the inroads made by the Polish national identity and the Polish school system, and just you couldn't exist if you couldn't speak Polish. So you see this, and Hasidim aren't necessarily secularizing, but once they have bridged the language barrier, everything else becomes open. This is especially an issue for Polish Jewish women at the time. The other piece is the land of Israel. We know that the British take over. This is seen as a great thing for the Zionist movement. And so we are back to our first talk about what ought to be the relationship of the Jews in the diaspora to the land of Israel. And there is no uniformity of opinion. In fact, the Zionists were the least popular party coming out of World War I. And they never attained a huge majority for the Jews on the street, by the way. Jews were not, even if they could have, they weren't in flocks trying to get to Palestine. Desperation drove many of them to try to get to Palestine, apart from the ideologically driven one. So we're going to discuss that. So what is really important for you to grasp as we move on to the themes is that Poland here becomes the center of a political struggle over the future of the Jewish people. And this is why I think the schism in this era is so important to the schism in our era. Because the Jews of Poland were trying to figure out what was to be the future of the Jews and the future of the Jewish people. And they had a multitude of answers. And I think that we are at an era now where we are also trying to figure out, those of us who care, not only about the Jewish present, which matters to us, because the Jewish present certainly mattered, but also trying to think about where are we going. And the schisms are an outcome of the various answers that Jews are coming up with. So that's something for us to keep in mind. Okay, so let's take a look at the following issues. How did external events impact the Jews and in some ways encourage political factionism and divisiveness? That's the first thing we're going to take a look at. The second thing that we're going to look at is this concept of ideological zealotry, which brings us back to our first discussion about the zealots in the Second Temple era. Why was it that Jews at this time were so driven by ideological beliefs? And I'll just give you we'll speak about this a bit more, but the example of language. People were ready to kill over whether Yiddish should be declared the language of the Jewish people or Hebrew should be the language of the Jewish people. There were so many fights to the point that the people who believed in Yiddish wouldn't work with the people who believed in Hebrew. even when it was in their mutual interest to do so. So that's another question. And those zealots of Hebrew ended up having to capitulate in some ways because the vast majority of Jews spoke no Hebrew. So this is another piece of that we're looking at. We're looking at people who are driven by a kind of zealotry over various topics. And the other piece in that ideological zealotry that we're going to look at is the Jews have no real power. So why are they so ideologically crazed? That's something we have to look at. The third piece, and this again takes us back to our original talk, is the theme of a messianic impulse that's propelling political activity. But in an odd twist of fate, the messianic impulse is not coming from the religious. In fact, the Agudas Yisrael are anti-messianic. They're like, we don't want the Messiah. We don't wait for the Messiah. We wait for the Messiah. We don't do anything to hasten the Messiah, the Hasids are saying. It's the secularists, the socialists, and the nationalists who essentially take this messianic impulse that's in Judaism and Jewish tradition and transform it in a new way. And this is one of the reasons, by the way, why the Hasidim, who found Agudas Yisrael, can't stand their secular opponents, because they say that they are perverting Jewish concepts in a way that's making them betray the Torah. So we'll take a look at that. All right, so let's first look at this external political, social, economic, and cultural factors. I've referred to them a little bit, but what you have in Poland is essentially a yo-yo effect going on in the Jewish community. Poland is a new state. It has tremendous problems. It has an basically peasant, impoverished population. It was hugely affected by World War I. It had several wars after the end of World War I. It had a Polish-Soviet war that was very brutal. It had a Polish-Lithuanian war. And so it's a state effectively in disarray, trying to get its act together. And the Jews are a piece of that very chaotic environment where different groups and factions are fighting for a piece of the pie, so to speak, and a decision and a participation in the decision-making process. Now, it started out as a country, according to the Paris Peace Treaty, committed to democracy. But in that chaotic atmosphere, this commitment to democracy dwindles to the point that in 1926, one of the heroes of the Polish nationalism, Józef Piłsudski, who was the Jews loved, but they really only loved him because he was better than the worst guys who were horrible. It's one of those that it's actually quite true. And he wasn't an enemy of the Jews, and he actually believed in a more federalist state, but he didn't really help the Jews. He just didn't do things to make it even worse. He carried out a coup d'etat in 1926, and he stayed in power until 1935. So effectively, as of 1926, Poland becomes a kind of authoritarian state. Yes, it has a parliament, but there are limitations on democracy. This makes the situation actually worse for the Jews in some ways because they have less negotiating room. That's another piece. As after 1935, when he dies, a right-wing party, a nationalistic party, comes in, and they are blatantly anti-Semitic. They pursue policies that seek to either impoverish the Jewish community and marginalize them from the economic life, or to get them to leave. But of course, there was nowhere that they could go, and the Polish state didn't have a lot of power. So it was an outright effort to rid Poland of its Jews. So this is one of the reasons why, in this crisis atmosphere, as we all know, crisis forces people often into radical reactivity. And so this is one of the reasons for the fractiousness that various groups, the socialists are arguing for one piece, the Zionist nationalists are arguing for another piece, the Nationalist Socialist Bund is trying to go for another way, the religious are trying to hang on in a different way, because they're all responding to the inability of the Polish state to solve its larger problems, but also to figure out how to deal with the Jews who more and more are seen as, and this is the word that the national rightists use, a foreign body in the heart of Poland. And if I could just, this is painful. It says, and this is not the Nazis, but this is what they say. This was the head of the Nationalist Party. He writes, "In the character of this race, the Jews, so many different values, strange to our moral constitution and harmful to our life, have accumulated. that assimilation with a larger number of Jews would destroy us, replacing with decadent elements those young creative foundations upon which we are building our future. So it's a hard time to be Jewish in Poland, and it's a hard time to be Polish in Poland. That's the truth. That's another piece that we have to be aware of. The other piece here was that Jews in Poland saw themselves as what they called in those days a national minority, what we might call today an ethnic minority. And the Jews of Poland wanted national minority rights. They went to Versailles arguing for them, the Polish Jews. What did that mean? They wanted separate schools for Jews, paid for, supported by the state. They wanted councils for the Jews, permitted as part of the functioning of the state. They wanted their own cultural affairs. So they really, in some ways, wanted to function as an autonomous national group. They weren't the only ones. The Belarusians wanted that. The Ukrainians wanted that. But the Jews were all over the place. And this, so the Poles resisted this. They were forced to sign a minorities treaty, which said that they would allow for the existence of Jewish schools and support them by the state, and that they would not force Jews to go to school on Sunday. But they resented it like hell, and they never ended up giving any financial support. So that's another piece. As I had mentioned before, the notion of Poland for the Poles became, as the era went on, more and more pronounced. And so Jews were not seen as Polish. They were not seen as ever being able to become Polish, even through assimilation. Now, I should say that the Polish Socialist Party did feel that there was possibility of assimilation, which is why many Jews, including some of my family, gravitated towards the Socialist Party as perhaps offering hope for integration into the Polish state. But they were edgy about it because they didn't want to seem like too many Jews were belonging to the Polish Socialist Party. So that was another piece of it. So effectively, the left and the right in Polish politics was opposed to national autonomy, and the Jews had a completely different perspective, and they kept fighting, but they were fighting not only with the Poles, but with each other about what that meant. Did it mean Yiddish, territorial autonomy? Did it mean Hebrew, with having rights in Poland, but also in Palestine? And they couldn't agree. And then, of course, there were the ultra-Orthodox who said, they don't want any of this. Let's just keep in the shtetls and mind our own business. And you're making more fuss by attracting attention to the Jews. That old idea that this is not a good thing. So you have this very complex society. And then, of course, you have the economic situation that when people are being pauperized, which is what happened to the Jewish community, you once again try to resort to desperate means. And the Polish Jews, especially the young ones, felt a deep sense of despair, and they gravitated towards some sort of panacea, which of course didn't exist. Which leads me to the second part of the second theme, which is the ideological zealotry. Faced with this Polish state that was unwilling to integrate them properly, although it must be said that these parties were legal, whereas in the Soviet Union, all political activity was crushed. So the Jews were allowed to have these political parties, and in fact, you would see there were Hasidic rebbes in the Polish parliament alongside of Zionists. We'll talk about this momentarily. Zionists, the Bundists didn't get too much to the Polish parliament. They were more active in the local councils. So you had the Jews as a very visible presence in the political process, coming at it, though, from very different points of view. And this was one of the problems, that they could never get their act together to have a unified platform against which to challenge certain things that were happening in Poland. So this ideological zealotry, there are three components of it. One is the factionalism about ideas. Second, and we'll take a look at that, is the political mobilization. So how did the Jews who cared about all of this, what did they actually do to try to get people to their cause? To get somebody to become a member of the Bund, to get somebody to join the Socialist Zionists, to get somebody to join the Aguda Israel, or the National Religious Party, which was Zionist but religious at the same time, which we'll get to. And then finally, the battle for the Jewish street. How did they do that? So we'll take a quick look at it. So first of all, what were some of the topics driving this factionalism internally rather than externally? Well, one that drove people crazy was where to solve the quote-unquote Jewish problem. Namely, people don't like Jews. Jews are economically in trouble. What do we do about this? And so some, like the Bund, for example, argued very strongly, and as well the Agudas Israel, the problem has to be solved here in Poland. This is where our population is. It's a pipe dream to think that you're going to evacuate 3 million Jews to the land of Israel. It doesn't work. And they were adamant. And on top of that, the socialists, for example, felt we want to create alliances. This has been our home since the 800s. Why are you kicking us out? Why should Jews be forced to leave? We should stand our ground and make alliances. On the other side were people who said, there's no hope. We think that the land of Israel is the only place. And they felt just as passionate about emigration as the socialists and others, the Aguda, who felt that felt about staying here. It was called being here or being there. And this gave rise to intense controversy. The other one, which I already referred to, was language. This was one of the markers of modern nationalism, is the ability to claim that you have a real language. Language is an identifying marker of nationhood. So for example, the French, they crush all of the regional languages. The same with the Germans and the Italians. This was the way to establish the reality of having one nation. So the Jews were divided between those who said Yiddish is our language because 95% of the people speak it, and they wanted to elevate Yiddish. This is where you get the creation of Yiddish culture and Yiddish writing. They wanted to prove that Yiddish wasn't jargon, as people called it. It wasn't a dialect. It was a true language that was an expression of the nation of the people. And then you had those who said, no, Hebrew is the true language. It's the language of the Bible. It's the language of our ancestors, and we have to bring it back to life again. Of course, the religious thought that was much more sacrilegious than Yiddish. They thought that was a complete heresy. Hebrew is the Lashon Kodesh. It's the holy language. You don't use it to say, I have to go to the bathroom. You don't use it to do politics. So that created incredible divisiveness. Then the other piece was the issue of the Jewish identity in terms of secular, national, or religious, or some combination. And people simply could not agree. There was no essential identity for the Jews. Now, the religious would say, the Jews are a nation only by virtue of Torah. The secular said, the Jews are only are a nation by virtue of history. So these were very passionate, and the secular religious rift became stronger and stronger as time went on. The final reason for this ideological fractionalism was that, in fact, because the Jews didn't have any real political power, there were no real rewards for figuring out how to work together. Does this sound a little bit familiar, unfortunately, about our society today? Okay. In truth, factionalism makes it impossible to figure out how to advance your agenda over time. This is different than good, honest debate. So I'll give you just a very specific example. In 1918, at the end of the war, there was a dramatic increase in anti-Jewish violence. There were pogroms, tragically led by Poles. And there were two very significant ones, one in Lwów and one in Vilna. And if you can imagine it, the Jewish councils in those cities, because they had Jewish councils that had been established, in fact, by the Germans, they could not get together to figure out how to have a common defense against the anti-Semitic violence. They were infighting while the pogroms were going on. So this is a real problem as you move on in the era. This continues, and in fact, it gets worse. So I just want you to understand that the Polish state, they benefit from this fractionalism because they use it as a wedge to drive their own anti-Semitic agenda. The other problem is that, on the other hand, you have these traditional anti-Semitic notions that, oh, all Jews are the same. Well, the Jews didn't seem to get that. Hey, they think we're all the same, so let's pull together and be unified. It had no impact. It didn't make any dent. So that's another piece. The other part is this the political mobilization. So what do we have here? Here, in a fascinating way, we have a generational gap that creates a highly politicized Jewish youth. What happens here? Well, during this time period, young Jews see that their parents, that the older generation, their parents and grandparents, do not have answers for the problems that these young Jews are facing in interwar Poland. Whether it's the rabbis or the traditional ideas about not attracting the attention of the Gentiles. And so young Jews have a transition where they leave their homes and they join parties in massive numbers, starting already at elementary school age. And these political parties take on the role that parents and elder generations used to have for them. And they become indoctrinated. These are parties we sort of, well, maybe in some ways, do we still have this? I don't think we have anything similar to this today. But they are basically indoctrinated into a specific worldview, and they don't have a lot of contact necessarily, although there's some back and forth. The parties become like bubbles. The parties also provide services that are beyond their political, like they create schools. You have a Yiddish school system. You have a Zionist school system. You have an Orthodox school system. And you have the Polish school system, but they're not interacting with each other in constructive ways. They have camps to take the kids away, the young people. So this is a time when the political mobilization of the youth leads to these strong differences in ideological opinions. The other piece is that these young people want to break with the idea of the old Jewish, let's not bother the goyim. Let's not bother the non-Jews, and they want to adopt a very proud, whether it's Bund or Paul Etzion, they want to be bold and proud. So they're kind of outdoing each other in front of the Gentiles. How radical can they be? How much attention can they get? How many party supporters can they have? And so it becomes in some ways a competition to attract the attention of the non-Jews, but one that ends up not benefiting the Jews very much. The other piece is here that the new Polish state is secular, although the Catholic Church has a lot of influence. It's highly nationalistic and sort of democratic, although it becomes less and less democratic. And so the Jewish political parties, to a great extent, start mirroring some of the behaviors and patterns that you see in the Polish political parties. So just as you have your right-wing nationalists that are highly militaristic and ethnocentric, the revisionist movement led by Jabotinsky, he admires those types. He says, I don't like them for us, but we should go over to the land of Israel and we should create our own military paratroopers and we should kick the Arabs out so that we can have a Jewish state for the Jews, just like the Poles have a Polish state for the Poles. So they're mirroring the behaviors of the Poles. The other piece is the regional differences. We can't ignore them. We can't go into it. But the Jews who came from Austro-Hungary, they tended to be more moderate because that the Austro-Hungarian Empire had a more tolerant view of the Jews. The Jews who came from the Russian Empire were highly radicalized, and they had a much more a proactive stance. And then you had the Jews in what you call Congress Poland, which were heavily Hasidic, and they had a different take. So these different geographical distributions are finding it difficult to make their peace with different political styles that they've inherited from the empires that they were a part of. Which leads us to the battle for the Jewish street. So the battle for the Jewish street takes place in city councils, the Polish city councils, where Jews run on Jewish political platforms as part of Jewish parties. It happens in the Kahila, which is the religious sort of organization of the Jews, but which secular parties start competing because there are resources at stake for schools, for newspapers, or other things. Then at the Sejm, which is the lower house of the Polish parliament, they also are competing for seats, membership at the Polish Sejm. And why is this important? Because these different factions, which have such different viewpoints, they are all trying to shape the Jewish population's image of itself, and especially the Jewish youth. What does that mean? They're asking themselves, what is the future of the Jewish people supposed to look like? I get back to that question. So let's take a look at what the Zionists would be asking. What's the ultimate goal of Zionism? They will present. But guess what? The Zionists don't have a unified front. The general Zionists will say, the goal ultimately is a homeland, but we need to work here. They call it Gegenarbeit. We need to work in Poland to try to get the Jews to understand the importance of Zionism, because we know that most Jews aren't going to be able to go. Then you have the other Zionists who are very, who you could call them the Polish, the Zionist socialists, the pioneer groups, who say, no, we want to go and develop the land of Israel and establish a socialist state in the land of Israel. And then you have the revisionists, Zionists, who say, we want to evacuate as many Jews as possible and set up a essentially militaristic state on both sides of the Jordan River that's anti-socialist and capitalist. Well, all of these different viewpoints, they're trying to get votes from Jews to represent their political perspective. Now, within this context, you have three general groups. One are the Polish Zionists of various streams, and they tend to be, at the national level, the most successful. Why? Because they're a counterpoint to the nationalist sentiment of the Polish Poles. So they tend to do well at the national level, but when it comes to the city councils, how am I getting, what are my taxes? What about delivery of water? There, the Jews tended to vote for the Bund, for the socialists, because they felt that the socialists were more concerned about the issues that faced everyday Jews. And then, of course, you have the Hasids, who, once they get their act together, as of 1916, and then they keep going, they actually do pretty well. They hang in there with the secular parties. But even there, we have divisiveness. Why? Because the Gerer Hasidim, they're saying, yes, we're going to found a political party and we're going to get involved. We're anti-Zionist, we're anti-socialist, we're pro-Yiddish. We're going to knock those guys off because we want to preserve traditional Judaism. But guess what? Their cousins, the Belz Hasidim, say, no way, you have no right to get involved in politics. This is completely against Jewish tradition. So the Hasids don't get the support of the other Hasids. So even there you have internal factionalism. So this leads to the third theme of the messianic tendencies, and we're soon moving to the end of my part of the talk. So Judaism has a strong tendency that it suppresses towards messianism. This messianic, the age of the Messiah, when all the exiles will be brought together to the land of Israel, when there will be peace among nations, the lion will lie down with the lamb, etc., etc. And traditional Judaism, rabbinic Judaism, says, yes, the messianic era will come, but not too soon. So don't pay too much attention to that. Just stay focused on the present. This was the moderateness of Talmudic rabbinic Judaism. But the strand is still there. And in this interwar Poland, that messianic impulse rears its head among the secularists, among the socialists, and among the nationalist Zionists. So, because messianism, as we saw in the first talk, is a response to a deeply problematic present. That's when messianic impulses rear their heads, when people do not feel that the present is going in the right direction. So, for the Jewish socialists, socialism was really a new religion. They saw it as preaching salvation open to all humankind, and they were part of a vanguard, even if they were persecuted. What does that sound like? Sounds like the Jews of the Temple era, both Christians and others who said, we may be persecuted, but we have the truth. So that was one piece of it. Okay? Now, Jewish socialism truly is dead today. It may live on in echoes of liberalism, both in Israel and the United States, but for all intents and purposes, the high ideals of Jewish socialism maybe even died as early as 1920 for some, but certainly with the death of socialism and amongst the Jews in America, certainly by really the New Deal co-opted Jewish socialism. And then in Israel, with the rise of Likud, you really see the downfall of Jewish socialism. On the other hand, it was one of the great visions of modern Jewish politics. And why was it so powerful to Jews at this time? Because it had the vision of an alliance, a yearned for alliance among those who were attracted to it, between Jews and all progressives in the world. The dispossessed, the powerless, this is a prophetic vision in many ways. Let's struggle together for a better world. The Jewish socialists also were very bold in fighting fascism and Nazism. And that was another important piece. Now, the nationalists, Jewish nationalists, wanted to win something else. They wanted to have the respect of their nationalist-minded neighbors. We today, with the State of Israel and with the success of American Jews, we cannot understand how bad Jews felt about being Jews in this time period. They felt that Jewish life was so low on the status of peoplehood, that people saw the Jews in such a bad light. And they wanted to raise up the status to make them proud of being Jewish, okay? And for example, some of them said, look, the Poles only lost their state 150 years ago, and look how low they are on the totem pole now in the world. We lost our autonomy 2,000 years ago. That's why we're so degraded. So they felt, these nationalists, that dignity and respect would only come when they had all of the components of nationhood, just like their Polish neighbors, so to speak. You also had, on the Zionist side, the revisionists. They had this myth that of the unity of the Jewish people, which we know by now was never truly in place. They said, all Jews must come together, secular and religious, right and left. There are no classes in Judaism. We're all the same. And these revisionists, this is one of the reasons why they absolutely reject binationalism in the land of Israel, the idea of Arabs and Jews living and working together. On the contrary, they felt that they needed to establish a monolithic nation state that was a Jewish state. Now, Jabotinsky was liberal, but I think that ultimately his political views tended towards, I hate to say this, but they had fascist overtones to them, as much as he may have ideally been liberal in his understandings. So for those Jews, and there were many of them, perhaps even the majority, especially those who were prepared to leave the confines of the Jewish ghetto, so to speak, the possibility of dignity, of self-respect, of redemption of Jews and the world for people who had been victims of humiliation and discrimination was very strong at this time in Poland. So, but they didn't all see things the same way. So, the left and the right, so to speak, became much more powerful than the center, as often happens in times of crisis. And so what were these messianic longings? All right, they wanted a perfect society, whether it was in the diaspora or in the land of Israel. We all know that there is no perfect society, but these people believed there was. They wanted a reign of justice, either under the rule of the rabbis, and that's still a powerful impulse today in Israel, or under the rule of Jewish socialists, or under the rule of Jewish nationalists, but they all had some notion of getting justice for the Jews. And the other piece was this idea of an era of redemption. Now, at the end of the day, Zionism becomes the most attractive messianic impulse. Why is it? Because it combines the messianic tradition that you have in traditional Judaism for a renewed and healthy Jewish community in the land of Israel. And it incorporated socialism for those who needed a socialist view. It incorporated militarism for those who needed a militaristic point of view. There was this profound psychological need of the time for self-respect that Zionism seemed to be able to elicit in people. And the truth of the matter is that there, in fact, was even a messianic figure for these Zionists. And who was that messianic figure? It was the pioneer. The nationalist socialist represented the fusion of the socialist idea of progressive humanity with a nationalist view of dignity for the Jew. And you even have one who was very spoken of, Joseph Trumpeldor. So we even have our messianic-like figures, okay? And often, tragically, Palestine was seen as a tabula rasa. It wasn't, of course, it wasn't a clean slate, but there was this fantasy on some level that we could establish this completely new Jewish society with new kinds of Jews, with all varieties of Jewish groups, and we could project all of our hopes for that onto Palestine, because in Poland, boy, it sure doesn't looking good. So this is another piece of it. To the point that, and I'm gonna close in 2 minutes, today some of us are distressed, I know I feel distressed, when I hear about proposals that come out of certain Israeli parties for transfer of Israeli Arabs, however you want to call them, Israeli Palestinians. Well, for example, the Israel Beitenu party says, let's redraw the map so that Israeli Arabs who are living now in the state of Israel will redraw the map so those large concentrations will be in a Palestinian state, and the Jews who are on the West Bank will be part of Israel. And groups say this constitutes some ethnic transferring. This is a violation of the Geneva Conventions. But what we have to realize is this is actually not coming out of nowhere. Why? Because in the 1930s in Poland, Jabotinsky was willing to work with the anti-Semitic parties for the evacuation of 750,000 Jews from Poland over 10 years. This notion of transferring the population of Jews was not seen as very odd. So most of the Jews, by the way, weren't with him, because they couldn't see necessarily that a Holocaust was coming, but they didn't want to uproot themselves. So again, we'll talk about this more a little bit, the way the period, more than a little, the way the period continues into today. So I want to just close with a short reading from another book and then give you three questions that we can think about when we come back. So this book deals with the history of the Agudas Yisrael, which was the Hasidic right-wing religious party that still exists today in Israel and is quite influential. It's a swing party in determining the Knesset votes. So the author writes as follows. This survey of the history of Agudat Yisrael in interwar Poland could have come to an end here in 1939. But in a very real sense, it continues in the Holocaust period and beyond. In the United States, and especially in Israel, Aguda has persevered and successfully adjusted to new political and social environments, though its present posture can be understood only in the light of its interwar history. So we'll be able to take a look at that. So three questions to leave you with. First of all, when we discuss the idea of Jewish divisiveness, we really need to understand what we mean by the notion of a Jewish nation. We want to think about this because this has important implications for us as diaspora Jews and for Israeli Jews. When we talk about wanting a Jewish democratic state, what do we really have in mind? This raises the issue of ethnic nationalism or civil nationalism. And how does the state of Israel reflect some of these earlier concerns about what does it mean to call ourselves a nation, okay? The second piece is, what does it mean to be a modern Jewish nation? There's a little bit of overlap here, but we talk about Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, but does that mean the same thing as calling ourselves a modern Jewish nation? All right, that's another piece. And the third thing to think about is the role of religion in the life of the Jewish people today, in America and in Israel. Clearly in interwar Poland, the religious parties got on the bandwagon and decided that they had to carve out a territory. What about us today? What should be the role of religion in Jewish politics? So we'll stop here, and then we'll pick it up with your questions and concerns afterwards. Thank you.